we get off the elevator on the 10th floor. I kind of check to the left as we're getting out of the elevator. Then we start walking right. I hear something behind me and like turn my head a little bit. And he is standing there with his gun already out and starts shooting.
Hey gang, have you ever watched an ASP video and thought to yourself, man, what happens when the dust clears? Someone's just been in a defensive shooting, they've had to deploy a firearm to protect themselves and their families, then what happens? Firearms legal protection is there, so you win the fight after the fight, and you're able to carry on with your life. You know, defensive legal memberships abound, there's a lot of companies out there. Firearms legal protection is the only one that Active Self-Protection recommends. They're helping to train and educate the self-defense community, and that is why they're invested in bringing these educational and training videos to you. Please thank them for their support and consider them for your needs. Check out their plans at get-asp.com/FLP. get-asp.com/FLP. All right, folks, welcome back to the Active Self-Protection Podcast. I am your host, Mike Williver, your favorite former Fed. With us today, a man by the name of Gabe Tauscher. He is from Wisconsin, and he had a pretty harrowing critical incident that happened back last year on May 29th of 2021. And he is kind enough to come and share his story with us. Gabe, how are you, sir?
I'm doing all right. It's another damn paradise.
Are you originally from Wisconsin? Are you from the Midwest your whole life?
Kind of. I was born in South America, adopted. I grew up here, was stationed in California, and I've lived in three other states.
Okay. So, but Wisconsin is home now. You like the cold, apparently?
I actually don't. I'm not back here by choice.
Okay, well, in that event, you can come join me in Tucson. You won't have a lot of cold to worry about. It's plenty warm out here.
I have thought about it.
Well, there's plenty of room. Come on down. So Gabe, tell us, you said you were born in South America. What country?
Paraguay.
Oh, very cool. So you were adopted by Americans, is that right?
Yeah, that's my birth name was Esquivel, but I am a Tauscher now.
That's pretty cool. Paraguay. I would have expected Brazil or some bigger country, but that's really neat. So you came here how old to the U.S.?
About a year and a half, 2 years old.
Okay. So have you been back at all?
No, I was actually planning on going back in 2020, but you know, then the whole COVID thing happened.
Yeah. That laid a lot of plans to waste. Mm-hmm. So where would you say is the main place you grew up that spent most of your time?
Mostly Wisconsin.
Okay.
Town called Oconomowoc.
And do you say you were stationed in California? Are you in the service?
Yeah, I was in the 0341 in the Marine Corps.
Oh, very good. Thank you for your service. I truly appreciate it. Where in California were you?
I went to boot camp in San Diego.
Okay.
Right next to the airport. And then I went SOI West on Pendleton. And then I'm about a couple miles up the road to Horno, 53 area on Pendleton.
Very cool. Yeah, I spent the last, up until 4 years. I moved here in 2018. I spent the last 23 years as a Fed in San Diego. So I'm familiar with all of those places. If you live in San Diego, you can't throw a rock without hitting a Marine or a sailor, which I loved about that place. Now I'm in an Air Force town. So the good news is I've always had military planes flying over my head no matter where I live. Gabe, you had an incident happen to you last year. Before we talk about that, because I don't know what happened, as I tell all my guests, I like to hear about your incident and learn about it at the same time my audience is. Before we talk about the incident, did any of what happened to you in the military, any of your training kick in at any point during this critical incident, or was it not possible?
Yes, actually. The corpsman in my company threw my platoon, I believe most of the company, through a CLS or Combat Lifesaver course. And I believe that it's because of this course that I knew to how to stem certain bleeding, and it essentially saved my own life.
All right. So just in your own words, take your time. We have all the time in the world on this show. Just walk us through the incident. Where were you and what happened?
So this happened in Minneapolis, Minnesota. So I work as a private security contractor doing a lot of EP and PSD style work. And when I was up there for the Brooklyn Center protests and riots, I met, you know, me and the hotel manager kind of hit it off, and her and I started seeing each other, went official on social media. Everything was great. When we went official, her ex started stalking her. He quit his job, stopped eating, stopped sleeping. And so because she's saying, you know, this guy's a threat, I went down to Florida for a bachelor party. And things kind of came to a head. Apparently, he was trying to hang out with her again, showing up at her house, that kind of stuff, because he knew I was gone. So I went back up there, And he got to the point where he was staking out her work and like was sitting in front of the hotel doors because she worked night shifts and was staying out there all night. So the day I got back up there, I, you know, picked her up. She came out the back. I picked her up and, you know, to calm her down, went to some like a farmer's market type thing. And then I took her back to the hotel room, or not the hotel room, her apartment. And we get to the parking garage, and this guy has been blowing her up, like, all morning, texts, really crazy stuff. I'm like, but we should not go back in there. Just in my professional opinion, like, you know, you're telling me this guy has a bunch of guns, and, you know he's unhinged. You showed me all the texts. You put me on speaker for some of the calls. He's not right in the head. And now you're telling me he might have a key to the building. So I had no doubt in my mind this guy was going to be inside. But she was stubborn. It's like, well, I'm not going to be scared to go into my own apartment building. And, you know, trying to be, I don't know, I guess a good boyfriend and the protector that I am, I opted to not let her go in there alone. So I went with her. we get off the elevator on the 10th floor. I kind of check to the left as we're getting out of the elevator. Then we start walking right. I hear something behind me and like turn my head a little bit, and he is standing there with his gun already out and starts shooting.
So he didn't say anything. He didn't warn you, nothing. He just started shooting at both of you or just you?
Just me.
Okay. He didn't say a word.
Yeah. And no point after this, cause her and I had been seeing each other for over a month now. And no point after this, he tried to message me on social media, tried to say anything to me, phone call, anything. And when we made eye contact, like in that hallway, he didn't try to say anything. Gun was already out, started shooting the second that I looked in his face.
How long did it take you from the moment you turned around to realize he had a gun? Was it instantaneous? Because frequently people in a situation like this won't see the gun right away. But that wasn't the case. I'm assuming he just started firing immediately. So you knew what was going on. It didn't take your brain any time to adapt to the situation.
I mean, it was, you know, it was instantaneous, but I honestly feel like I saw the gun before I saw him. I thought I was screaming, but apparently I didn't make a noise. It was just internally, you know, a bunch of noise inside my head. I was lucky. I tried to turn to face him, and he was just unloading like around a second or quicker. Okay. And luckily, because I had started turning when I saw this, most of the bullets that hit me up and down the left side of my body. So I have like 3 in my hip, like 5 in my left arm. I did get my lung punctured. And then he did actually get me once in the back and actually once in each butt cheek as well.
Okay. So that's a total of how many rounds it actually impacted you?
Total was about 15.
Wow. That's unreal. Once the shooting stops, had he struck her with gunfire at all?
No. It stopped momentarily. I don't know if that was the first or second time that he was reloading, but by the time the shooting stopped momentarily, I saw him, he was reloading. So that was me thinking, okay, I'm still alive. I have an opportunity. And that was where, you know, we'll get to that part in a second, but that was where I decided to shoot back. But I'm, you know, obviously I can't prove this, but I'm convinced that if he had gotten the chance to finish reloading, that was when he was going to kill her.
Yeah, I mean, that's a perfectly reasonable supposition for you to make. I mean, at this point, you're down on the ground, I assume. Is she still standing there next to you?
There was like a little kind of divot dip type thing in the hallway. Mm-hmm. She was able to kind of duck into that when the shooting started, and she was screaming, like she knew it was him. Like she yelled like, "Well, stop," a couple times, and she was like yelling "stop" it while the shooting was happening. So I don't know if she was directly in the line of fire and could have gotten hit. I mean, she was a foot away from me, and he was maybe 10 feet away from me tops.
Okay, so you were carrying your own firearm that day.
Correct.
So walk us through that. At the moment you realize you're down on the ground, you've been all shot up, and you realize he's reloading, what happens then?
I'm a left-handed shooter, and I usually carry with my between 8 and 9 is usually where I keep my holster.
Okay.
And so I'm like, okay, the shooting stopped. I've got an opportunity. I tried to draw, and that was when I realized my left hand didn't work. Like my left arm just didn't respond at all. So I tried pulling it out, you know, tried getting my hand in there in between my waist and my gun, and I didn't work. So I actually ended up drawing my gun upside down, believe it or not.
With your right hand?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I was just able to fire one round. I might have hit him. I might have missed. Nothing I found in the news said that he had more than one bullet wound. So I think I like to try to convince myself that I hit him, but I don't really think I did. But that was enough to kind of spook him, and he ended up running away.
So at this point, he's left the scene. You figure he's gone. He's not coming back. What's your next course of action? You're down. You're obviously bleeding from all sorts of places. What do you do first?
There are a few seconds there that I couldn't see him anymore, but it was, he ducked into the little elevator. There was like a little square, a little box where I couldn't see him, that I didn't hear any elevator ding or anything like that. So I, due to blood loss, I kind of end up like dropping the gun. I end up flipping it upside, right side up, and, you know, I was picking it back up in case he jumped back out. He had just taken cover and was going to try and shoot me again. And so I held it there for a bit, the best of my ability, until one of the neighbors came out. And he was standing, like, if the guy was still there, he would have been able to see him.
Okay.
So he asked, hey, is the shooter still here? And that was when I was, I acknowledged he was gone, and I realized how badly my left arm was bleeding, and I realized I couldn't feel anything from like the middle of my forearm down. So kind of trying to attempt to triage my own wounds, I figured that I had a brachial bleed.
Okay.
And I used whatever strength I had left to try and find the brachial artery and clamp down on it, as well as keeping my left arm elevated. And then I felt like one of the worst, as far as the holes and the spots and the nerve screaming went. One of the other really bad spots was my armpit. So I figured that I had a hole or two in my lung. So I rolled myself on my left side and, recovery positioned myself, hoping that, whoever was coming would get there before the blood filled up my bad lung.
So were you aware that you had internal bleeding? Could you feel it? Because I think people would be interested to know if you're bleeding internally, if there's something you can actually be able to tell consciously or not.
I can't say I could tell that I was bleeding internally. That was kind of a guess that I made based on where I felt the pain on my left side.
So at this point, walk us through what happens next. I assume someone called paramedics and or police. Who showed up first?
The neighbor who came out and asked where the shooter was, he's actually the one listed on the police report. The guy's name is Aaron Peterson. Unfortunately, still by the time I was healed enough that I could walk and drive again, he had moved out of the complex.
Oh, okay.
So I haven't been able to thank him. But yeah, he ended up bringing towels out, and he was also the one that let the police in, because you have to key card in to the apartments in this building.
So you went down and let him in?
Yeah, and they actually detained him.
Yeah, that's pretty standard procedure. So his name's Aaron Peterson, you said?
Yeah.
Well, shout out to Aaron Peterson. If he's someone who's willing to act in such a way, there's a possibility he watches Act of Self-Protection, maybe listens to this. So maybe he's listening right now. So thank you, sir, for that. That was well done. Most people, I would say, would probably just stay in their stay in their apartment and just pray to God they don't get shot. So well done him.
Now, if you lived on the 10th floor of 9th and LaSalle in downtown Minneapolis, thanks, ma'am.
Yeah, absolutely. So he lets the police in. He is detained, which is to be expected, because they don't know who's who yet. And then are the police the first responders to get to you and talk to you? And what do they say?
So they, two of them ended up coming up immediately. One of them kind of button, because it's a, it's like a Y-shaped hallway. You know, the bottom of the Y is the elevator, the little square the elevator's in, and then the hallway, you know, forks off. So one of them button hooked to the left and cleared that and just kind of like basically held that ground. The other one came clearing to the right. And he saw my, you know, he saw my gun. He saw my now ex-girlfriend, like huddled over my body, and he goes, "Where's the shooter? Where's the shooter?" As he clears past her, and she's, you know, she's yelling back that he's gone, but he still had to go up and finish clearing the rest of the hallway just to make sure, sure. that no one was up there. And so he cleared up that end, and he's actually the one, he came back, he was out of my vision, but he actually came back down, and he's the one that put the tourniquet on my left arm.
Okay.
And then, so they cleared that. And once they, the police deemed it was clear, that was when either the, I assume it was an EMT, but it was just a, it said medic, and he was wearing a flak, like black vest, flak that just said medic on it.
Hmm.
And he was the one that came up and put the tourniquet on my right leg. One of the last bullets actually did clip my femoral, my right leg too.
So it did actually, it actually nicked the femoral artery?
Yeah.
But he got a tourniquet on that leg. Was it your right or left leg?
Right leg.
So do you remember them getting you out of there? And did you take a helicopter ride, or was it just an ambulance ride, or what happened?
Luckily, Hennepin County Medical Center. I had to remember the acronym. It was like the number one trauma center, like in the Midwest, basically. And where my ex lived is like a 5-minute walk from there.
Okay.
So they were able to just, you know, take me down and put me in the back of an ambulance and then drive me over.
So what do you remember about arriving at the hospital and how that went?
So the last thing I remember, like I remember them coming in, but like the EMTs coming in, grabbing a stretcher, putting me on the stretcher. Like my memory's kind of getting a little blotchy at this point. I assumed it was a blood loss or adrenaline crash or something. And they, you know, took me down the elevator and put me in the back of the ambulance. And at that point, like, at that point I kind of started feeling safe. Like, okay, there's a chance I'll survive this. My nerves were still screaming. So I actually looked up at the EMT or paramedic, I don't know which is correct, in the back of the ambulance and said, "Give me some painkillers."
Right. Yeah. Understandable.
And, and so that's like, they did end up hooking me up to something. It was probably just saline, but that was where I lost, like, I thought I passed out. I lost memory, but apparently I was actually still conscious until they got me to the hospital, because the first medical note in my jacket actually says, patient arrives still conscious, muttering obscenities.
Well, you had a lot of fight in you, apparently. Muttering obscenities. That's kind of very funny. I would be proud of that if I were you.
Yeah, that is kind of a point of pride. I don't know. My in the family I was adopted into, my grandparents on my dad's side both lived to be over 100 years old. So my joke for the last probably decade or more has just been like, I'm a Tauscher. Tauschers are too stubborn to die.
Yeah.
And that's part of the justification I'm using for still being here to be able to do this interview.
Well, I'm saying if you write a book, which I think you might want to do at some point, I think Too Stubborn to Die might be a good title. So just something to keep in mind. So Gabe, tell us, can you walk us through the surgeries? Do you know what all they did to you while you were under, and how long until you were conscious again?
So, I was very heavily sedated, like borderline comatose. This happened, you know, May 29th. I started coming back to reality and being coherent around the end of June, beginning of July.
Okay.
They had to, they had to reattach the median nerve in my left arm. And then they're like, I don't actually know what a lot of the surgeries are.
That's fine.
That happened in my left arm. My left arm is scarred all the hell.
Yeah. Since you folks at home can't see it, he and I can see each other, and he's wearing a sort of brace covering on his left forearm.
Yeah.
It looks rather tight. What is that for?
This is actually because of my last surgery that I had. because there were a number of plates in there, and so they took all the plates out to try and restore some of my movement to my left arm.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still working on getting the nerves back. This is all I can do with my left hand.
He's wiggling his fingers for those who can't see.
But yeah, I can't bend any of the knuckles or anything like that.
Yeah, just barely moving his fingers.
They said that if everything goes completely perfectly, I could potentially be left-handed again someday. Might be at least another year or two.
How do they fix a lung that's been shot through and punctured like that?
I'm trying to remember. It's what it's called, like a tension pneumothorax. And so I learned a little bit about it because my dog actually had to have basically the same procedure I did about a month after I got out of the hospital. And so first they have to, you know, get any extra blood or excess stuff out of the lung or anything that may hurt the lung. Then they patch the hole and then they try to fix everything back up so that it works. They might have to remove part of the lung depending on where it is. So they had to do that. I needed a splenectomy. I no longer have a spleen, which basically, apparently, I didn't know what the spleen did before this, but apparently that means I don't really have an immune system anymore, and the common cold could potentially kill me.
Wonderful.
Yeah, right? He shot off the tail of my pancreas, so I needed what I believe is called an endectomy to fix that. I had a couple follow-up surgeries involving that. And then I needed what's called a fasciotomy on my lower right leg. That's because of the way that my femur was nicked caused the blood to improperly flow into the lower half of my right leg to the point where it ballooned up and tissue started to die. So that was what they call when they just cut the leg open to let all the excess blood out. And then they had to, you know, patch the femoral, and I think it's called debridement, where you just remove dead tissue.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, one of the muscles that helps you move your foot up and down is called the tibialis anterior. I am currently missing most of that on my right leg, so I need a brace to walk.
So you're out, you're borderline comatose for better part of a month at this point. So you come to, you wake up, who's there? What do they tell you?
So my family actually took off of work, and either one or both of my parents were there for the entirety of it. And then I had your friends rotating, girlfriend rotating. And it got to the point where with a couple of the contractors I worked with, my mom got together and wrote a script where anytime I woke up, they would basically say, "Hey, you got shot. You're in the hospital in Minneapolis. He's dead." Yada yada. And that was how they'd film me. Like, "Do you know where you are? You're in the hospital." So it was, it sucked waking up at first because, so it was more sedation than comatose, because apparently during the first week when I was heavily drugged up, I tried to escape multiple times. So when I came to in like late June, early July, I was like restrained to the bed. And because of the lung issues, they had hooked me up to a respirator and like I had a trach. And so like, you know, I got a scar on my neck now from that. Because of that, and the breathing tube and all that they had to do, I was unable to talk and I couldn't move. And it was, that was not fun.
Yeah, that sounds terrible. You know, that legitimately sounds an awful way to wake up.
Yeah, I'm a little bit of a control freak. And I don't know if something bad happened to me in childhood where I blocked some memories out, but I'm like extremely terrified of being restrained in any way. So like to not be able to move or talk, I'm just going to stop myself because I'm going to throw a few expletives out there if I continue that sentence.
That's fine. I can bleep them out. No worries.
Fair enough. So yeah, it was, that was a long process of itself, just like training my vocal cords to let me speak again. I mean, I'm still a little, hoarse from it.
Yeah, I can hear it in your voice.
And yeah, that's, you know, oh, from the hole in my neck. Yeah, they had, you know, speech pathologists, and there was some special tool they hooked up to my trach, and that I basically whispered for like the entire month of July. One of the first things I said, like I tried to speak at first, one of the first things I actually said was, "I'm Batman," because I thought I sounded like Christian Bale.
That's great.
But yeah, even coming out of the borderline comatose status, like the drugs they had me on are really strong. So I was seeing double up at least through mid-July.
Do you know what kind of sedatives they were giving you at the time?
I know I was on fentanyl and a couple others in that family.
Yeah, I as an aside, I had a cardiac catheterization procedure when I was young, about 19 years old. And they gave me Dilaudid through an IV. And I've been asking doctors for Dilaudid ever since, because it was that wonderful of a sensation. But that's neither here nor there. About how long were you in the hospital after you were conscious?
So when I came to, I was still in the ICU. So hospital, I was probably there for another month. And then they moved me into a rehab, like an inpatient rehab facility, where they basically did like the Wounded Warrior thing, where that was where I learned to walk again and all that.
How long was that rehab stint for?
That I got out of the hospital, that was about another month. So I got out of the hospital in late August.
So at what point in the hospital do you find out whether this person's been arrested or what the disposition on the person who shot you was, and what was that like?
That was actually immediate, because he died that morning.
The morning you woke up?
No, the morning of the shooting.
Okay.
He led the police on a high-speed chase that ended in, I believe, the town of Elk River, Minnesota. And they either spike-stripped him, or they might have pitted him, or he lost enough blood that he lost consciousness and crashed his car. And the police had him surrounded, so he ended up taking the coward's way out.
And by that you mean killing himself, or making the police do it for him?
He shot himself in the head.
Okay. And we don't know if one of the rounds, or the round you fired, actually struck him during the incident, right?
We don't. As I said, I like to convince myself that my round hit him, but I haven't been able to find any definitive proof to back that up.
I want to go back to when you were talking about you and your girlfriend, her getting off work, you going back to the building. Mm-hmm. Frequently on this show, we have people that will tell us in retrospect that there were red flags about whatever incident they were involved in. I have yet to hear of an incident, certainly not on this show, where there were more very obvious red flags than what you described, of someone being clearly not in their right mind, contaminated thinking, very passionate about his ex-girlfriend. And it seems like you were pretty convinced that there was a very, very good chance he would be in that building. If you can go back and do something differently, would you have just... I mean, how would you have handled it? Because I'm struggling to imagine how you could have kept her from going in her building even by herself if she was sure it was okay.
This was something I spent extensive amount of time thinking about in the hospital. And I guess the best, you know, the best conclusion that I've come up with, like if I could go back and do it now, even knowing that we were going to eventually end up breaking up, I still think I would have gone in with her. The one thing I would have tried doing differently is, you know, I got a buddy, my buddy Neil, who I very frequently work EP gigs with. Like we worked the riots, the George Floyd riots in Minneapolis, both, you know, pretty much every job involving Minneapolis together. We worked hurricane relief together. Like he's like my ride or die. And if I could do that over when I was driving through Wisconsin, I would probably would have stopped and picked him up, or like would have, you know, called him and let him know what was going on, so that maybe we would have stepped out of that elevator together and, you know, he wouldn't have left the hallway.
Right. So explain to us what you discussed working the Floyd riots and other things. What exactly is your job title and what does it entail?
technically, I'd say private security contractor, but I do a lot of executive protection stuff. So usually it's, you know, whoever calls. I do a lot of workplace violence stuff where, I mean, that's a lot of that's boring. Usually just sit in your car outside of a building. But the stuff I enjoy doing is actually working for the media. yeah, so I'm not going to say which media outlet, but usually it's, you know, embedding in a news crew is, you know, say an intern or, you know, a backup camera guy or something like that. And, you know, being an advisor, and if anything gets too heavy, pulling them back.
Okay. So we might have seen you on a cable news screen at some point during the unrest back in 2020.
Not if I did my job right.
Right. Okay.
I think I stayed behind the cameras.
I don't know if you remember this, but there was, I can't remember what city it was in, but there was a demonstration / riot going on, and some private citizen ran into a police car and grabbed like an AR, and there was a, I want to say it was someone doing your job, observed this and drew down on the guy and made him put it back. Do you remember that?
Yeah, that, if I remember correctly, that was Portland.
That guy was doing the same job you were doing, basically.
Basically. I mean, I feel like I wasn't able to look. I didn't actually look into him. A couple of the guys I work with did. Seeing he was some sort of contractor. I don't know if he was hired to guard a building during all that, or if he was with a news crew, or what he was doing. But, I mean, if, you know, someone's running around with a rifle they stole from the police, they probably don't have the best of intentions with it.
No.
And I'd say he did a good job.
Yeah, he was my hero for about a week there. We had another guest on not too long ago who he does, what do you call it, chaos reporting. So he goes to interesting places and deals with Chuck Holton was his name. He was on recently, and he has security and, you know, experience with self-defense stuff and also from the military side. And so he feels confident going places and doing stuff like that. But that's absolutely nuts to me when I think about like the Andy Knows of the world, the people going in to cover this stuff and try to bring some balance to the reporting to show people what's actually going on in, say, Portland or Minneapolis. Those people are very, very brave to do what they do, because I've been in situations like that as a law enforcement officer, and it is not a good feeling to be in the middle of an angry crowd of irrational, unreasonable, violent people who will assault you for zero reason, absolutely no reason whatsoever. So I commend you for doing that work. That's just crazy to me.
If you're as much of an adrenaline junkie as I am and have that extra screw loose, you find that stuff fun.
So do you plan on, if you're able to recover sufficiently, do you plan on going back to doing this kind of work? Is that your goal?
I would like to, yeah. It's something I genuinely enjoy doing. So yeah, if I can be a left-handed shooter again and figure my stuff out, then yeah, I would definitely consider going back into the field.
You mentioned a couple times if you can go back to being a left-handed shooter. Did you ever train a non-dominant hand before this all happened?
I did. I took a few courses and played around with it on my own time, but not enough to feel as confident as I do with my left hand.
Right.
I still wouldn't say I'm a bad shot with my right hand, but I'm nowhere near as good with my right as I would be with my left.
This whole thing, I'm guessing, probably took less than 10 seconds. Is that, you think that's accurate from the time you started shooting?
I'd say for sure less than 30.
Because even though Gabe may or may not have even hit this guy, just the presence of a firearm and Gabe's willingness to use it was enough to convince this guy that we're done here. I'm gonna beat feet, because that's what cowards do. So, Gabe, is there anything else you wanted to discuss or touch on that we didn't talk about?
I think we covered most of it.
Okay.
I guess the one thing that they never told me that getting shot makes you fat.
Really? Do tell.
I mean, I guess as severe as the injuries have been, I was in pretty good shape before, but because, you know, I've had to, it's been a very slow uphill battle learning to walk again, learning to use my left arm again and all that, you know, I haven't been able to go hiking and exercising, and I'm still not medically cleared to work out the way I used to. So, I mean, most of me staying in shape was physical exercise. So because I can't do that, it's been a little bit harder keeping the pounds off.
Well, you were shot 15 times. That's your excuse. I just retired. That's why I'm fat. So don't feel too bad about it. I'm sure, judging from what I've learned about you in the last half an hour, I'm sure that once you're able to, you're going to get after it and lose all that weight. Gabe, I want to thank you for coming on. I know this stuff's not easy to talk about, but I appreciate you coming on and being willing to talk to our audience about it. And keep in touch. And I wish you all the best in the future. And I hope you recover completely.
Thanks. Appreciate that. Thank you for giving me the time.
Take care. All right, gang. You know what time it is. It's time for The Gutowski File, starring our friend Steve Gutowski. He is the founder of TheReload.com and the host of the Weekly Reload podcast. You can find the Weekly Reload podcast on all your major podcast outlets. And is it just clips on YouTube, Steven, or do you have the whole show on YouTube?
Now we got the whole thing up there and clips, so you get the best of both worlds.
Very cool. Some really, really good guests and very informative conversations. And if you look back a couple of weeks, you get to see Steve firing a fully automatic weapon and grinning like an idiot, like we all do when we fire a fully automatic weapon. That looked like a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was from when I was at SHOT Show. Had a good time range day, because that's where you get to play with the real toys that they don't let you own without special paperwork and spending, you know, five figures.
Right. Tax stamps and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So this week we are discussing, we don't mean to pick on the NRA, but the NRA is having some problems. So this week we're talking again about the NRA, this time about their revenue, which there is an article on TheReload.com written by, I believe you, right, Steven?
Yeah.
About the revenue being cut in half since 2018 while spending spiked in 2021. And if I read that correctly in the article, the lawyers' fees are like 20% of the total costs, their total output, or the money they're putting out every year, which is, I'm not an expert, but that seems like a lot of money. And it seems like it's got to be taking away from some of the programs that people send their money in, hopefully to fund. You want to talk to us about that?
Yeah, that assessment is exactly right. They've spent $31.1 million through the first 8 months of August, which is what this internal report that we exclusively obtained and published covers, that period of time. And this is really a very detailed report. It's nothing like this has been made public before. So, you know, NRA members and anyone concerned about the organization can now see exactly where it spends its money. And one of the biggest expenses is legal fees. It's actually the second biggest expense. And these aren't necessarily fees that are going towards funding their gun rights activism in court. You know, like obviously they've supported the case that's in front of the Supreme Court right now.
Yeah, that was my next question.
Yeah, those are funded by a separate part of the organization. They have a special 501c3 set up for most of that activity. But these fees are mainly going towards defending the organization from lawsuits by its former contractor, Ackerman McQueen, and then also the state of New York, which is trying to shut it down over accusations of corruption levied against Wayne LaPierre and other members of the leadership, where they're accused of having, you know, diverted nonprofit funds, the NRA's funds, towards their own personal expenses, which we've talked obviously at length about before. But yeah, it's really having a significant impact on their operations, because that's 10 times more than they've spent on some of their core services combined, things like education and training, competitive shooting, community outreach. Those combined are less than 1/10 of what they spent on legal fees.
So just as an NRA member, as a person sitting at home, what are the average members supposed to do? I know this is straying into editorialism here, but I mean, people have got to be frustrated. I know I am. And, you know, you go to the NRA meeting and you don't have any real voice there. No one's listening to the members, it seems like. And the board and LaPierre seem to have closed ranks, and they're just kind of doing whatever they want. I mean, I'm not sure how we fix this. It's become like a cancer. I mean, 20% of your total cost going to not, and again, folks, let's be clear, not to legal activism, not to suing a city who has a crappy gun law, but just to defending the members of the board, defending Mr. LaPierre, for example, against stuff they've done that was patently foolish. I just don't know how we fix this. Do you have any thoughts on that, Stephen?
Well, it seems a lot of members are voting with their wallets at this point because the NRA's membership has also shrunk since 2018. The membership dues have fallen by almost half in that time,
which is
a tremendous drop. And they've responded by cutting a lot of the services, like we mentioned earlier. And so, one thing I would say is they haven't really had a full-fledged members meeting at the NRA in 2 years because of the pandemic. They've canceled their annual meetings, the big event that everybody goes to, where they have the members meeting, which is the part where people can get up and pass resolutions to about how the board should operate and things of that nature. There is a mechanism for regular members to actually put forward their own resolutions. And this, in fact, the last time it happened was in 2019, and it was a big blow up. Yeah, there's a huge amount of dissension that was made very clear during that meeting, and they haven't had another one. They've had them, but they've been obviously restricted by COVID, and so they haven't had them during an annual meeting. And perhaps that is a way that an average member could actually make their thoughts known. It's difficult to change the organization through the board elections, primarily because the board gets to decide who's on the ballot for being on the board, if that makes sense. There's a committee.
It's crazy,
but the board. Yeah, the nominating committee. And the vast majority of board members who make it onto the board are picked by that committee to be on the ballot when they go and send out ballots for voting. So they served for 3 years, so they're not all up at one time. You'd have to undertake a campaign over several years to reform the board to get, I guess, if you wanted to say get rid of Wayne LaPierre, right? It was just a lot of what people want to do before they would start giving money to the organization again. You'd have to wage a multi-year campaign to elect Wayne skeptical board members. And it's just a very difficult thing to do. Because the other thing is to be a voting member, you also have to either be a life member at the NRA or have been a consecutive member for 5 years. To be nominated for the board, you have to have been, I believe, a life member for 5 consecutive years. So there's a lot of ways that it's restricted in how the average member can actually affect change inside of the organization. It's not impossible, but it's very difficult. And frankly, there hasn't been much of a sustained drive to do that from the outside.
Do you get the sense that the average NRA member knows what's going on? That they know about the lawsuit? They know about the crazy bankruptcy? I mean, I feel like if the average member knew, they'd be making more noise. And could some of our more celebrity type members make some noise maybe to draw some attention to what's going on? Because I feel like as long as people are distracted and they don't realize, hey, this stuff's going on, at the very head of the organization, they're not interested in making a change. So the Ted Nugents of the world could make enough noise to draw attention to it. Maybe we could see some change, because I feel like you said, as long as LaPierre is there, it's like Dan Snyder on the Washington football team, Redskins, Commanders. As long as he owns that team, I feel like they're never going to prosper. And I think LaPierre is just so embattled, and there's such a aura of negativism around him. I feel like as long as he's there, nothing's going to change.
Yeah, well, that's a key question. How do you get access to NRA members? Well, generally, you have to go through the NRA for that. They're the ones who know who the members are. We still don't have, we don't have like an accounting of who all the NRA members are. And so the only people that have that are the ones who run the NRA. So, and you have a question of trust. Obviously, a lot of NRA members trust the NRA and its leadership. They trust Wayne LaPierre because he's been leading the organization for decades, and they've seen the organization have a lot of success in that time and obviously be attacked by a lot of people from the outside as well, including news media. So that's you have a very serious issue with trust among NRA members for anyone who's outside the NRA. So yeah, they probably heard about these things, but the NRA leadership and Wayne tells them that things are fine, or they've been corrected, or you know, they're not a significant issue anymore, or there's a lot of lies about what happened. And I think a lot of people tend to believe that. But like I said, I mean, some of them, like a significant number of members, clearly aren't buying into that anymore because they have a declining membership rate. They aren't at 5 million members anymore, and they haven't grown since 2018. In fact, they've declined since that time. And you've seen a huge decrease in planned giving as well. People giving from their estates, from their wills. That's fallen completely off the cliff in 2021, according to their own internal numbers. And that's another sign of perhaps people not wanting to commit long-term to the NRA as it currently stands today.
You know, folks, if it weren't for my friendship with Stephen Gutowski and my membership at thereload.com, I probably wouldn't know about this. So if you're hearing about this here during the segment and nowhere else, that should tell you something that you need to know. And that is that, and I'm going to challenge you today to go over to thereload.com and get a membership. And I'm going to ask you to tell a couple of your friends who are enthusiast, Second Amendment people, who are maybe NRA members, who are into firearms and care about the future, that sort of thing, to go to the Reload and get a membership. Share this podcast with them, because none of this stuff's going to change unless a light is shown upon all the shenanigans at the top of the NRA. So we need you to get the word out. Share this show, share the Reload, and just get the word out, because otherwise nothing will ever change.
And it's not about attacking the NRA either, right? Nope. I mean, it's about telling NRA members the truth about what's going on. Whether that's pretty or ugly isn't up to me. And these numbers are in black and white. People can read this report for themselves. It's made by the NRA itself, by the treasurer there. So, it's not about trying to tarnish Wayne LaPierre or the NRA as an institution or whatever. It's just about trying to tell people what's happening so they can decide for themselves how things should go, especially if they're somebody who's given money to the NRA.
And we've said this before in this space, but if the NRA ceases to be, that's a problem. It's a problem for everybody, because there is no single organization out of these smaller organizations. We're all doing great work, but they're just not big enough. They don't have the resources and the funds to defend the Second Amendment the way the NRA traditionally and historically has. Folks, if you are lamenting the lack of down-the-middle, sane, sober reporting on the Second Amendment, on firearms in general, I encourage you, please, to go over to thereload.com, carefully consider getting a membership, tell a couple of your friends who you know, if you're a gun person, you know other gun people, let them know thereload.com, thereload.com, share this show with them, and let's try to get some stuff done. Stephen, thank you so much for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hey friends, this is John Correa. If you like the podcast, if it is bringing you value, do me a favor. Just rate the podcast and leave us a rating and a review. It really helps us out.